I'd like to walk through just a quick introduction to today's presentation and our speaker. Again, you should be here for the NARPM and OSC Academy Presents NHPA for RPMs and OSCs. This webinar will provide OSCs and RPMs with an overview of the National Historic Preservation Act, or NHPA, and the requirements of Section 106 under CERCLA. The focus will be on EPA's Emergency Response and Removal Program. NHPA applies to your response action if your action constitutes an undertaking and will have a potential effect on a property that is eligible for or included in the National Register of Historic Places. We'll be joined today by Earl Liverman, who retired from EPA in 2015 with more than 25 years of experience as an on-scene coordinator, or OSC, and remedial project manager, or RPM, for EPA in Region 10. His experience includes 15 years as an OSC with responsibility for emergency response and removal actions to address threats posed by the release or discharge of hazardous substances and oil, 7 years as an RPM OSC. He also spent 3 years as an RPM and then also worked on federal facility sites. Prior to joining EPA, Earl spent about 10 years involved with state environmental management and natural resources activities. So I want to welcome Earl. Thank him so very much for joining us. And I'm going to go ahead and call up his presentation material and pass the baton over to Earl whenever he's ready to get started. And Earl, allow me to help you adjust your volume and feel free to begin.
All right. Well, good morning, everyone, from sunny Sisters, Oregon. When I retired, my wife and I built a new home in Central Oregon. And it's 100 degrees, and yes, we're receiving much of the smoke from Northern California and elsewhere. Pretty dire out here. All right, throughout this presentation, I'm going to show you a number of sites that are included in or eligible for the National Register of Historic Places. This is just to give you a sense of that broad spectrum of the types of sites that could fall under the 106 process. And I hope you get a true sense for the diversity. For example, the site shown here is a ranger cabin that is found in Baker County, Oregon. It was placed on the register in 1986. What's unique about this is this was built by the Civilian Conservation Corps, or CCC, a number of years ago, back in the 30s. And as such, it embodies a number of significant areas of interest, to include architecture, conservation, politics, and government. Which is to say, many of the structures and the areas that you'll see today, they're not your easily identifiable grand estates, but rather they can be seemingly very innocuous, and you need to pay attention to what you're doing. All right, here's what we intend to cover. There's going to be six sections, and as you're reading through this, I want to put out the following notice. This webinar is intended to help with the implementation of the National Historic Preservation Act under CERCLA. Please keep in mind that due to the diverse characteristics of CERCLA sites, I'm going to cover only the basics because, frankly, it's not possible to determine exactly how the Act may be implemented under CERCLA in a particular situation. If and when you should encounter this matter, please refer to your respective agency policy and guidance for clarification of the NIPA regulations and provisions of the statute. And I say this because for those of you who might be RPMs within the realm of remedial, it's extraordinary the way in which the regions and others have worked to address this issue. And although it may be more straightforward in the removal program, it nevertheless can be very challenging for any number of issues, many of which we'll go over here this morning. Okay, in this module, we'll start with an introduction to the National Historic Preservation Act. We'll discuss the 106 process in broad terms, and we'll also have a discussion related to the definition of certain key elements which are crucial to understand with respect to the process. The National Historic Preservation Act was passed in 1966. It was done so in large part to the massive government-sponsored construction projects such as the interstate highway system and urban renewal in older cities, as that type of those types of activities became commonplace throughout the country after World War II. In fact, it's estimated that 25% or more of the nature's finest historic sites were lost during this period. So in response to a growing public concern about the loss of historic sites, Congress passed the act in 1966. The law established the national policy for the protection of important historic buildings and archaeological sites and outlined responsibilities for federal and state governments to preserve the nation's heritage. Section 106 is that portion of the NHPA that is concerned with what is referred to as federal undertakings. In short, what the act requires is federal officials to stop, look, and listen before making decisions that may impact historic properties. In addition to 106, the act also authorized the National Register of Historic Places, as well as the National Historic Landmarks Program, in many ways similar to the scope of CERCLA, but only for historic sites. Okay, very quickly, this is an overview of the 106 process. It begins with the initiation of the process itself. In other words, the federal agency determining that the proposed action is an undertaking. Now, prior to this, there's arguably that step that the federal agencies consider as to whether or not they should even trigger the 106 process. For example, there were any number of emergency removal actions and removal actions that I completed over the course of my career, wherein it didn't take a whole lot of effort to determine that the 106 process would not was not applicable to my action. For example, imagine a small residential house in a heavily urbanized area, and there was the release of mercury. And the ultimate cleanup was the removal of the free mercury and perhaps some contaminated carpet and the like. Well, that's not the type of situation that I initiated the 106 process in response to. And please keep in mind that you do not have to explain why an ARAR, which we'll talk about more later on, is not selected. So it's not as if you have to put a note to the file or something of that nature explaining why you did not choose to initiate the 106 process. On the other hand, at almost all of the mine sites that I cleaned up, the 106 process was integral to my overall efforts, because clearly the remnants, the historical remnants of mining structures and whatnot were important, and we'll talk some more about that later on. So the federal agency determines whether the proposed action is an undertaking, and if it's the type of activity that has the potential to cause effects to a property that is eligible for or included in the National Register. It's very important that you keep that in mind, whether that it's eligible for or included. Step two, if you make the determination that there is that property, you move into step two. Otherwise, you move out of the 106 process and you need to go no further. Step two is where you determine what's referred to as the APE, or area of potential effects of the undertaking. Extraordinarily important concept that we will talk about later on, and it's as important as the notion of how you delineate your site, both with respect to on-site versus off-site activities. If you've determined that there are historic properties found within your APE, then you move on to step three, otherwise you move out. and that's the assessment of the adverse effects. And please note that within each one of these blocks, I cited the regulation for the 106 process. It's 36 CFR, Part 800, and I've broken it into those particular subsections that are applicable for these major topics. So you make an assessment of adverse effects. If, based upon your assessment, you conclude that there are no adverse effects, you're out of there. However, if you've concluded that there are adverse effects, then what is expected of you is that you will look at ways to avoid, minimize, or mitigate those effects, and we'll talk more about those issues here soon. Okay, responsibility for compliance lies with the federal agency funding the project or action. Now, please keep in mind that we're talking about CERCLA here. And as such, I trust everyone recalls that pursuant to Executive Order 12580, there are a number of federal agencies that have been delegated the response authority under CERCLA. That includes EPA and the Coast Guard, along with DOD and DOE on facilities that they have jurisdiction over. And there's also limited response authority to certain other federal agencies, such as the Bureau of Land Management, for non-emergency actions. So even though the EPA logo is shown, this is not intended to slight those other federal agencies that have the response authority delegated to it under CERCLA. The 106 regulations do not mandate a time frame within which the federal agency must complete its review. However, throughout this presentation, we'll address the importance of entering into a consultation with SHPO and others as appropriate, as early as is possible to do so that you avoid any last-minute issues that might otherwise arise and could have effect of throwing you off schedule or otherwise increasing costs or the availability of personnel, equipment, and the like. Okay, what is the federal undertaking? Well, it's any project, activity, or program either funded, permitted, licensed, or approved by a federal agency. It may take place on or off federally controlled property. Okay, here are a couple of examples. With EPA first, it's if you're conducting a fund lead cleanup action or you have oversight of a PRP lead cleanup action. The preceding slide was a non-time critical action that I completed a number of years ago that had both fund lead and non-fund lead or PRP lead cleanup activities. It might include the Bureau of Land Management permitting a company to build a road on public lands or to otherwise develop a quarry for construction materials. It could be a county highway department that's involved with the construction of new highways financed in part with federal funds. It could be FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, relicensing a private hydroelectric facility, the Army Corps of Engineers building or modifying a dike, or perhaps it's the Forest Service building a new recreation site or otherwise improving a site on National Forest System lands. So I hope this gives you a sense as to what the broad spectrum could be for what is described as an undertaking. What is a historic property? It is anything, prehistoric or historic, just about anything that's roughly 50 years old from the passage of the Act that is eligible for inclusion in or is in the National Register of Historic Places. This includes properties of traditional religious and cultural importance to an Indian tribe or a Native Hawaiian organization. The picture that you see here of two well-weathered structures is not a site that's on the register, but it's rather an example of a site that perhaps you might encounter on incidental to one of your cleanup actions, which should immediately set off bells and whistles that this is something that you should look at. Those properties that are listed or eligible fall into five broad categories. You're looking at buildings that refers principally to those that might shelter humans, a residence of something of that nature, barns, houses, and whatnot. Structures, things such as bridges, canals, roadways of all things. Sites, which are locations of significant events. Objects, those could be such things as sculptures, monuments, fountains, boundary markers, and the like, as well as districts, which can be particularly challenging because of their history or aesthetic value, and that might be residential areas, commercial areas, transportation networks, ceremonial sites, and the like. Okay, these are two examples, perhaps, of sites that you're not familiar with. The first on the left, the Crystal Lake Cemetery, was put on the register in 2004, and it's found in Benton County, Oregon. And for those of you who are from Oregon, Oregon State University is found in Benton County. The areas of significance include social history, exploration, settlement, and the like. And the road to the right is the Barlow Road. It was placed on the register in 1992. It was one of the first, if not the first, roads providing access across the Cascade Range from the east to the west. Its significance is, of course, transportation, exploration, and settlement. You may think this is uncommon, but it's not. There are remnants of the Oregon Trail found at many locations throughout Oregon, to include the Umatilla site up in northeastern Oregon, and the people involved with that particular site are addressing the very issue now of how do you go about thoroughly identifying and memorializing these sites, and that site, Umatilla, is well beyond the initial phases. Okay, the National Register, what is it? Well, it's the Register of Historic Places found throughout the country. Right now, there are more than 90,000 properties listed, which represents more than 1.4 million individual resources, such as buildings, sites, districts, structures, and objects. Almost every county in the United States has at least one place listed on the National Register. Criteria for getting on the register includes significance. Is the property associated with events, activities, or developments that were important in the past? What is its age? Is the property old enough to be considered historic? And that's generally at least 50 years old. And the integrity of the property, and that refers to the ability of the property to convey its significance based on its location, design, setting, workmanship, and the like. Another picture of a site, this is of the Avery Depot, the upper left, found in Shoshone County, Idaho, which is up in the Panhandle region of the state. The significance of this site is at one time was a depot station found along the Milwaukee Railroad, and at this particular location is where the railroad converted from fuel to electricity to get over the mountains into Montana. Simply because you have a site of this nature does not mean that it cannot be used. In the lower right-hand portion is the picture of the depot that you would see today were you to visit it. The building holds the local post office as well as a small museum and illustrates how historic purpose places can be used after having once been placed on the register. The Advisory Council on Historic Preservation generally oversees the Section 106 regulations. It also consults with and comments to agency officials such as EPA, Department of Defense, Department of Energy, United States Coast Guard, on individual undertakings and programs that may affect historic properties. If in the event there are disputes because of the inability of, Gene, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, I'm reconnecting here.
Okay. Everything is still up as you left.
Okay, well, let's keep on going in the hopes that it comes up soon.
Okay.
The advisory council is also there to assist the parties if in the event, here we go, there is a conflict that cannot be resolved. And I have a case study describing that very situation here later on. Okay, a number of important players in addition to the federal agency. One is the State Historic Preservation Officer, or SHPOs. Most 106 consultations will take place between the federal agency and SHPO, and possibly the advisory council. This, the dredge that you see is the Sumter Valley Gold Dredge, found in Baker County, Oregon, placed on the register in 1971, and its areas of significance is industry. In addition to the SHPOs, you may also find yourself working with a tribal historic preservation officer. It's very, very important to note that particular emphasis is placed on consultation with tribes, in no small part because of the extraordinarily unique and intimate relationship with the land and whatnot. For example, what you see here, the picture is a depiction of the Lovelock Cave, which is found in Churchill County, Nevada. The areas of significance for this particular feature is cultural. It's perhaps something that many people would simply not think of, but for the involvement, the early involvement of tribes in the consultation process. Now, during a prior presentation on SHPO and the Endangered Species Act, someone asked the question as to whether or not the SHPO or the THPO could be viewed as a trustee of historic property similar to a natural resource trustee for natural resources. And my answer to that is probably not. The reason is that the trustees, the natural resource trustees, are identified in the NCP subpart G at 300.600. It identifies the federal trustees, which include the Department of Commerce, Defense, Energy, Interior, and the Department of Agriculture, and also mentions state, Indian, and foreign trustees. Nowhere in the NHPA regulations will you find the word trustee used in the sense that it's used elsewhere for the natural resource trustees. Rather, what you see are the SHPOs and the tribal historic preservation described and discussed in terms of consultation. Now, does that mean there are no instances where a SHPO or a THPO might not also be designated as a trustee as well as a preservation officer? No. There might be dual hats worn by different people, but generally speaking, the SHPOs and the THPOs are not trustees. Okay, an adverse effect, another very, very important concept to keep in mind. Under Section 106, a federal agency determines whether its action constitutes an undertaking, and if so, whether the undertaking has the potential to affect historic properties. That does not mean that that is done in a vacuum. Moreover, there is no explicit obligation to actually avoid or minimize adverse effects. Rather, Section 106 encourages review, but does not mandate preservation. Examples of adverse effects include neglect of a property, which causes its deterioration, transfer of property out of federal control without adequate restrictions or conditions to ensure the long-term preservation of that property, physical destruction or damage, relocation of the property, change in the character, and the introduction of incompatible elements. With respect to the relocation, I had a site a number of years ago where the underlying landowner had a summer cabin that we had to move off site so as to complete the cleanup. Fortunately, that cabin was not 50 years or more older, and we didn't have to deal with it as a 106 activity. So please keep that in mind, and also the incompatible visual or audible elements. If you put in a treatment regime of some sort that disrupts the ambient conditions, and it has the potential to impact a site that's otherwise listed or eligible for, you might have to entertain 106. The area of potential effects, a very, very important concept. The little figure shows your site, and within that site, you would delineate the ape. In some instances, the ape could be the entire site. In other instances, it could be a much smaller sub-area within the site. When I dealt with 106 issues, I paid very close attention as to how the ape was delineated so as to ensure that my compliance with Section 106 focused on those matters that I needed to and not those areas that were unrelated to my activity. Okay, what is consultation in 106? Another important concept, and you'll hear about this throughout the presentation. It's the process of seeking, discussing, and considering the points of views of other parties. It's also important that you entertain consultations as early on in the process that you can so that the scope of your activity can be considered appropriately by all parties. And again, you do not necessarily have to seek consultation, in other words, trigger the 106 process, whether that's a sub-process that you go through within your site team, perhaps solely by yourself, but should you engage in consultation, it's very broad, and it's an activity that transcends all of the different phases of the 106 process. It's also important to note the distinction between consultation and concurrence. Consultation does not mean concurrence. In other words, the federal agency does not have to obtain the concurrence of the SHPOs or THPOs for that fact in its determinations. The regulations describe steps that should be followed if in the event there is a disagreement, and that is to bucket on up to the advisory council. I've had one instance where I was unable to come to mutually agreeable terms with the SHPO, and I'll discuss that later on as one of the case studies, but it's just simply important to note that there is a distinction between consultation and concurrence. Okay, and while we're on this topic, that while 106 per se does not trigger any other environmental compliance requirements, many other statutes may come into play dependent upon the site-specific situation. For example, the Archaeological Resources Protection Act, the Native American Graves Protection and Reparation Act, the National Marine Sanctuaries Act, the Antiquities Act, and moreover, many states have their own laws defining and protecting historic properties, which we'll discuss later on, well, actually in the next module. So just keep in mind, there are several other acts which could come into play of their own volition without having to be triggered necessarily by 106. Okay, and I've provided some reference here. American Council on Historic Properties website is an exceptional site, provides very detailed information with respect to a wide variety of matters, to include programmatic agreements, memorandums of understanding if you have to, just the flow chart of activities, interpretation of the regulations and the like. And if you wanted additional information on properties listed on the National Register, such as when were they placed on the register, what are the characteristics that cause for their placement or the like, you could go to the National Park Service's site and you'll find a wealth of information there to help you. All right, Gene, we're at that point where we could take a few moments for questions if there are any.
Thank you. So we did have a few questions that came in. Just a quick reminder, if you have a question or comment for our presenter, you can type it into that Q&A window at any time in the lower right corner of your screen. Let's start with a few that came in. One of our participants would like to know if the term tribe refers to any federally recognized tribe, if it only refers to federally recognized tribes, or is it any tribe?
It's my understanding that it is any tribes.
Okay. All right. Another participant would like to know, as far as federal facility sites, who would direct the 106 compliance in that case?
That's interesting. That would be the lead agency as designated under a federal facilities agreement or a tri-party agreement. So, for example, if you have a DOD, a Department of Defense facility, or Department of Energy facility, the lead agency would likely be Department of Defense or Department of Energy, and they would be the ones responsible for addressing the 106 issue. But that would be accomplished in the context of the agreement with the involvement and oversight of EPA, state, and other parties, such as tribal parties. And if I could go back to the previous question, tribes, depending upon where you might be located in the country, you may very well have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 or more tribes that are potentially involved with your site. Generally, when I've encountered those instances, the tribes among themselves will designate a lead tribal entity as opposed to 2, 3, 4, 5 or more getting involved. All right. Thank you, Jean.
All right. The next question, if a structure is more than 50 years old, would you always do an NHPA review?
No. And I tried to illustrate that by the example I gave of the small residential property within which there was a mercury release. That's incumbent upon the OSC or the RPM to go through whatever process they have in mind. With their team, with their management, pursuant to whatever regional policies and procedures might be in place. What it means is simply that you should give it some thought. And if you think it applies, there's no harm, there's no foul in initiating the 106 process by doing nothing more than contacting your SHPO and other tribal entities to solicit their early thoughts with respect to the site. Or you may conclude that that's not needed based upon the characteristics that you're dealing with. Age is certainly one factor that gets you across the threshold of at least having to give it some thought, however.
Okay.
Okay?
Can the 106 process be waived as an ARAR, which is not reasonable to comply with due to time constraints?
Yes. The National Historic Preservation Act, not the 106 process, but the act itself, is a location-specific ARAR. And we're going to talk about this in the next module. And to that, you would have to apply the 415 criteria for the OSC's compliance or the RPM's compliance with the act. And for the OSC, They look at things such as urgent exigencies of the circumstance, which includes such things as scope, scale, cost, and the like. RPMs, on the other hand, are in a more difficult situation because, frankly, they have the time and the like. But we'll talk about all of this more so in a little bit more detail in the next module.
Okay. I think in the interest of time, we'll go ahead and move on, but I'll just let the audience know they can continue to send in questions and comments. And, Earl, just a quick time check. We've got about an hour and 20 left.
Okay. All right. And I thought I wasn't going to have too much time. Okay. Module 2. We're going to discuss certain provisions that authorize and govern a response under CERCLA and the NCP. I emphasize this. It's CERCLA and the NCP. It's not the Clean Water Act. It's not the Oil Pollution Act. It's not the Clean Air Act. It's not the Toxic Substances Control Act. It's CERCLA. So please keep that in mind. Okay, what's interesting is that we mentioned earlier that after World War II, there was an abundance of major construction projects that did much to change, bisect, and in some instances destroy communities, all in the name of progress. So here we have an act that's designed to change effects. On the other hand, we have CERCLA, which is designed to change effects. That is, to clean up hazardous waste sites. The prior slide, the picture, this is just an example of any clover leaf, anywhere USA, except in Sisters. Here we have, this is the Bunker Hill Superfund site located in the Panhandle region of North Idaho. All right. Each year, EPA responds to hundreds of releases and discharges. Please keep in mind that those other federal agencies that I mentioned do so as well, those agencies that have been delegated the CERCLA authority. The decisions to perform these cleanups may affect historic properties, including those that are of traditional, religious, and cultural significance. This depiction that you see here is of the Painted Rocks in Arizona. If you look closely, you'll see a number of drawings that have been made on the rocks themselves. Okay, a couple of important concepts. Section 104A of CERCLA directs that EPA's actions to be consistent with the NCP. This matter of consistency is extraordinarily important and something that not everyone appreciates. CERCLA allows the United States to recover all costs not inconsistent with the NCP, provided the decision to incur costs was not arbitrary and capricious. In other words, for the agency to pursue a cost recovery action, they have to demonstrate that their actions, if challenged, were consistent with the NCP. Extraordinary amount of deference to the agency's expertise in determining consistency, and a shameless plug for the administrative record. If in the event a PRP or someone was to challenge the agency's consistency with the NCP, they would look to the administrative record only for their review. Section 121E of CERCLA states that no federal, state, or local permit is required for any portion, for the portion of any action conducted entirely on site. This concept is as important as the APE is if in the event you get into the 106 process. Some other things that I've had to discuss time and time again with SHPOs is this notion of ARARs, applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements. The three issues are the NCP requires only those standards that are promulgated, identified by the state in a timely manner, and are more stringent than federal requirements, may be eligible as an applicable or relevant and appropriate requirement. The NCP requires removal actions to attain ARARs, to the extent practicable, considering the exigencies of the situation. In a nutshell, what are the demands and the difficulties that an OSC has to deal with as part of the situation? And then the NCP with respect to RPMs requires that ARARs be met at the completion of cleanup action. Another aspect that I had to repeatedly explain to SHPOs and others is the scope of ARARs. That is substantive requirement versus administrative requirements. And by the way, the picture on the right is of a diversion dam and embankment found in Ada County, Idaho, that's southern Idaho, put on the register in 1976. Who would have thought? So I trust everyone knows what a substantive requirement is and what an administrative requirement is. For example, in the description of administrative requirement throughout various policy guidance documents and whatnot that EPA has published over the decades, you'll find specific statements such as approval by or consultation with administrative bodies, application for permits, documentations, reporting, and record keeping. Those are examples of administrative requirements that OSCs and RPMs need not burden themselves with. However, you'll also find, oftentimes mentioned, that EPA recognizes the benefits of consultation, coordination, and reporting, and other such practices, and strongly encourages people to do so. The reason why it's as an administrative issue, consultation and whatnot is not required is that, as I trust everyone knows, CERCLA has its own comparable set of procedures designed to promote the very type of consultation that's envisioned by 106, and we'll talk about that more later on. Okay. The NCP requires that only on-site actions need to comply with substantive requirements, and the ARARs or action chemical location. The picture that you see there to the right is the Oysterville Historic District in Pacific County, Washington. It's obviously a county on the Pacific. The maritime significance of this is great. How this might be an issue is, let's say an OSC's got to respond to a release of some sort at a building that's found within the boundaries of the district. Even though the building may not be 50 years old, he or she's going to have to look at their response in the context of the district designation. Okay, here we go. The picture is of a mausoleum located in Ada County, Idaho. It's put on the register in 1982. So under CERCLA, the National Historic Preservation Act is identified as a location-specific ARAR, which is what it would be. Location-specific ARAR restricts actions or contaminant concentrations because of a geographic or land use issue. Only the applicable requirements need be addressed, and only the substantive aspects of those requirements rather than the administrative need to be followed. Okay, and here's some references, both with respect to CERCLA and as a statute and the NCP. And I don't have, I can take any questions that there might be at this time, Jean.
So we did have one question that came in, and this is a site-specific one. Essentially, the participant is saying that they have a site in an area where there are nearby tribal resources like burial sites, but they don't know if there are any Native American burial sites within their APA until they actually start excavating. And they're just wondering if they should conclude that there is an adverse effect even before they may come upon such burial sites.
I would not make the determination that there is an adverse effect. But without any reservation or hesitation whatsoever, I would encourage this person to immediately initiate the 106 process with tribes so as to get their involvement. I say this in part because, as everyone I trust can appreciate, there's a sense of confidentiality and secrecy associated, oftentimes associated with these sites. And the characteristics, the values that they embody may not be readily recognized to someone such as myself or others, and could only be recognized and appreciated by a person associated with a member of the tribe. So that doesn't also mean in engaging them that the outcome of that will be the resolution of adverse effects. There's many ways that you could perform a 106 process early on to go through that determinative process to decide whether or not there is an effect, and if there is an effect, whether that effect is adverse. And if it is adverse, you'd certainly want to consult with the tribes as to how to go about mitigating or avoiding the potential impacts. So by all means, if you have even the slightest suspicion of something as significant as that, get in touch with your tribal representatives and have them give you a hand with that matter.
Okay, excellent. And so we'll go ahead and move on past this question break at this time.
Okay, three. This is largely for the OSDs, and it's a discussion of pre-incident planning and emergency response under 106. Now, with respect to pre-incident planning, to the extent that you find this matter addressed, it's likely going to be found in your area as an annex in your area contingency plans. If you're lucky, in the ACP, you'll have a geographic response plan that may have already identified for you culturally and historically significant sites. I suspect, though, what you'll find is very little, if anything, with respect to an inventory of anything other than just extraordinarily important, obvious, and conspicuous sites that have been identified and that are addressed in your ACPs. If in the event you do encounter such a annex, and it'll likely include the following steps. This is pulled out of the Region 10 area contingency plan, is that you'll identify the properties. You'll identify those areas that may have been categorically excluded, which we'll talk about here momentarily. You'll identify a call down list of parties to be notified in the event of an incident in a non-excluded area, and you'll develop strategies that can be implemented to help to protect those historic properties. So again, I suspect if OSCs encounter this, it's going to be in the GRPs. I've frankly never encountered it in GRPs or in area contingency plans. Now, pre-incident planning, you never know what you might run into. This is a picture of an incident up on the Lockstall River, which is in the Panhandle region. I had to respond to an incident that had both hazardous release as well as a discharge. As part of my efforts, I set up unified command, identified some areas that I wanted to use as staging or lay down areas. I did so in consultation with my federal counterpart, who was a part of unified command, the Forest Service, as well as the Nez Perce tribe. We were all set to move into this very nice area that you see here when, lo and behold, the forest archaeologist came by and said, you might not want to do that. And he explained that the service had anecdotal information that this at one time had was used as a stream crossing and also as a campsite for Native Americans. So I saluted, said thank you very much, quickly moved out and found a place to go elsewhere. So what this is to say that even despite your best pre-incident planning activities, consultation activities, you never know what you might encounter. Okay, the programmatic agreement is oftentimes what the OSC would turn to with respect to responding to an ER or an emergency action. It's very similar to the Endangered Species Act Section 7 programmatic agreement, and that this is a roadmap that OSCs can follow during the emergency phase of a response, which could last several hours or days for that fact. And for those of you who may not be familiar with what an OSC is, it's that person that directs response efforts and coordinates all other efforts at the scene of a discharge or release. And typically that person is found in EPA or the Coast Guard or in those other federal agencies that were mentioned earlier. It provides an alternative process to the 106. It's streamlined. It enables the agency to fulfill its responsibilities while not otherwise being impeded by having to follow the 106 process, and I've given you an site that you can refer to. It defines an emergency as that which shall be deemed to exist whenever circumstances dictate a response. As you can see, that's very open-ended. The responsibility for making that decision falls on the OSC. OSC should keep in mind, though, that when they call an end to that, it has consequences, and that is the standard 106 process would come into play. What types of effects might happen during an ER? Physical barriers, excavation, disturbing shoreline areas, field camps, staging areas, excavation, roads, and the like. I've got some pictures here for OSCs. Although this is a VOIL, it's not a CERCLA. Were that to have been a CERCLA release, it illustrates some of the issues that an OSC would have to encounter in terms of accessing wooding areas, bringing in equipment that's appropriately suited for the cleanup effort and the like. That clearly would be an example of an adverse effect. Other examples include having to construct berms. These could be across a waterway. These could be on land if you have free-flowing product. Who knows, but suffice to say, berms certainly are something that could have an adverse effect that clearly was constructed of by equipment and mobilizing equipment to the site, getting it in, pushing stuff around in the lot. Could have consequences. Here is more examples of shoreline cleanup where you would have a release of a hazardous substance that gets into the waterways. And here you have, you're trying to herd the material or otherwise remove the substance from gravels and whatnot. Here's another example of having to construct a road in wooded areas and berms. You can imagine what's needed to get a large excavator into those types of areas. Okay, if a site is categorically excluded, that's good. All these are sites that are agreed to in the programmatic agreement as sites that do not fall within the scope of the 106 process. If you're categorically excluded, you're out of there. However, the last step is that if you identify something, or arguably if you go beyond the boundaries, in other words, if you determine the boundaries of the categorically excluded areas to be more elastic than what they actually are, when in fact they're not, you could inadvertently trigger the 106 process. And here's some examples. You know, roadways, parking areas, drilling pads, airport runways, spills that are releases that stay in water bodies, borrow pits, concrete containment areas, and the like. You know, the concrete containment areas, it's important. Let's say you're an OSC and you deal with 112 issues, SPCC issues, spill prevention containment, and whatnot, and there's a release and it's confined within a diked-in area. Do you have to initiate 106? No, you don't. If it's a notice of a release of gas, and to the atmosphere. Do you have to initiate 106? No, you don't. I would be cautious though of roads and rights of way. I would make darn sure I knew what the width of the right-of-way was off the center line and all directions. That could be an area where you could easily run afoul of the categorically excluded areas and get involved in something that you would likely prefer not to. All right, if you're not categorically excluded, this is the process laid out for you. You get in touch with SHPO, and you have a conversation with them. You try to better understand what the properties or resources are. For Region 10, you would bring on board quickly a historic specialist to help to better define and delineate those historic resources and to develop protective measures. And all the while, you're consulting on both sides of this with appropriate entities, whether it be the SHPO, the public, other agencies, and the like. And if you conclude that there is the potential for an adverse effect, you take whatever actions are appropriate to mitigate or avoid, and then you notify the SHPO when the response is completed. All the while, you're taking copious notes because you're going to have to submit a report. So please make sure that you carefully document your thought process as you move through this. A couple of points for OSCs to remember. You may have to respond in such a manner that adversely affects properties. You may have to completely destroy the property. But that decision to do that needs to be an informed decision, and the way in which to accomplish that is through consultation and getting a hold of the types of expertise that you need to assist you in making that discussion. And you also, just because you've had someone out there that has initially identified those types of resources for you, as you proceed through your cleanup, you have to always remain diligent. Be very similar to the question raised earlier about Native American artifacts that are found on a piece of property that heretofore were not noticed. If you find something like that, it's incumbent upon you to seek the advice and assistance that's appropriate for making an informed decision as to whether or not you need to do anything differently, and if you do have to do something differently, how to go about doing so. All right, Jean, I can take any questions at this time that there might be.
Okay, we did have a clarifying question or comment that came in. One of the attendees wants to know if you've ever brought the NHPA Advisory Council into the process. And if so, was the council easy to work with?
Are they talking at the advisory council at the national level?
I'm assuming they
are.
Yeah, they confirmed.
Yes, and I'll discuss that as one of my case studies. And to be quite honest with you, they are a bureaucracy, and they responded as such.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. The next attendee has asked, is an OPA response excluded from 106?
Absolutely not. If you have an OPA response, then you're going to have to follow the 106 process without the benefit of the concept of ARARs. And so if you have a discharge and it's not the discharge, the product isn't commingled with oil, isn't commingled with hazardous substances, you're going to have to deal with the 106 process without the benefit of CERCLA, and in particular in being able to declare the act as a location-specific ARAR and focusing only on the substantive. If you have to deal with 106 as an OPA incident, you're going to have to go through the entire process, which includes, if a determination of adverse effect is made, entering into a memorandum of understanding or agreement, as well as possibly obtaining any state permits that may be required. It's only CERCLA that gives you the benefit of being able to work more expeditiously through the 106 process.
Okay. All right, that's all the questions we have at this time, so feel free to proceed.
All righty. Okay, in this module, we're going to do a brief comparison of the key elements of 106 under the National Historic Preservation Act and of CERCLA. The idea here, frankly, is to demonstrate that CERCLA, in my mind and in my experience, is far more encompassing of the 106 process, the concerns and whatnot, than is the 106 process itself. So this is basically the process that you see here. Consultation occurs, as you'll note, on the left-hand side throughout. Process complete if you get to any one of those three boxes, the first three boxes on the upper right. If you move through there and you make the determination that there is, for example, no historic properties that are adversely affected, you're out of there. However, one of the first look points, and it may be problematic getting to that. You may have issues with SHPO and others as to how you delineate your APE, your area of potential effect. You may have to go back and forth on that. But remember, it's consultation, not concurrence. If you really find yourself up against a brick wall, it's going to happen where you've made the determination that historic properties are adversely affected, and now you're going to have to work with SHPO and others to address those. And I've specifically said to address the effect considering the exigencies of the situation. So if at this point, if you fail to agree, and it's going to be on that fourth box, it's going to be 36 CFR 800.6, or it's going to be 104A of CERCLA that I would submit to you that's going to drive you into it. Remember that 104A goes to the consistency with the NCP. If you can't resolve your issues, then you're going to go to the council and you'll engage them and seek their advice. And I'll talk some more about that here on one of the case studies. Okay. Were you to go to the Advisory Council website, you would find the Section 106 regulations flow chart very similar to the chart that you just saw. In addition to that flow chart, you will find identified for you the key elements of the Section 106 process. And those include the role of participants involving the public, consultation, and documentation. As you look at that, and as we discussed it, please keep in mind that Congress is clear about its intent to provide opportunities for members of affected communities to become active participants in the Superfund cleanup process and to have a say in the decisions that affect their communities. This is nothing new to CERCLA. Okay, so with respect to the first key element, the roles of participants. What's shown on the left is the Section 106 process, what is described about this role. And it's relatively straightforward. It's a potential list of participants and their roles and responsibilities. On the other hand, were you to go to the NCP, you would find a much more complete a set of procedures for remedy selection and state and community involvement, as well as specific areas within the NCP that specify community involvement activities that must be undertaken at specific points throughout the Superfund process. I would refer you to the Superfund Community Involvement Handbook, dated 2016. I think it's an extraordinary handbook as far as handbooks go. There are chapters on community involvement during the remedial process, during the removal process, during enforcement actions, and also for federal facilities. And what's particularly attractive about this is that there's an appendix that lists the minimum community involvement activities mandated in the NCP. It's an exhaustive list. The point being is that CERCLA and the NCP require much, much more than what is otherwise required by the 106 process. Another key element is involving the public. You can see what's noted for the 106 process. And what's important about the 106 process is that it goes on to say that the approach should plan, whatever approach you take, it should plan public involvement appropriate to the scale of the undertaking and the scope of federal involvement. And it also goes on to say that agencies are encouraged to use their own procedures to satisfy the Section 106 general public outreach requirement. For the NCP, I've listed for you many of the sections and subsections wherein the whole concept of community involvement is discussed. Consultation, we've chatted briefly about this. It's the process of engaging others and where possible seeking agreement. As you know, we try to minimize conflict and as much as possible, and hopefully you can reach an agreement. If in the event you can't, please keep in mind that the 106 is consultation. It's not concurrence. And ultimately, as we'll see here later on, the decisions that the agency makes are those decisions that are reserved to it, not to other. And again, I've highlighted for you specific areas within the NCP where you'll find a discussion of dialogue, consultation, coordination, and the like. The last is documentation. I can't stress just how important it is for EPA and the NCP. The administrative record in particular, the AR, is that record that should contain all documents that the agency relied upon in reaching its decision. What's so important about that is that it's the administrative record that will be subject to post-judicial review if in the event there's a challenge to EPA's actions. The court will look at what's in the AR, not what's in the site file. And if you've made a mistake and you've realized you made a mistake, work with your attorney, cure it as quickly as you can. I've overlooked several things in my career, and when I've drugged myself into my attorney's office and said, hey, Richard, guess what I figured out? And said, not to worry, we'll cure it. Just realize how important it is to maintain that documentation. Okay, now I threw this in because for many sites, you might have mixed entities who are bringing together their CERCLA authority. So for example, let's say you have a mixed ownership mine site where, you know, the downstream portion is owned by the Forest Service and the upstream portion is patented, owned by a private party, and EPA comes in to assist with the cleanup of that. You could do that, and I believe you could, and there's ways that you could demonstrate compliance with the 106 process without necessarily setting some sort of a precedent for the agency that it would otherwise not deal with. Some of the ways that are out there is perhaps that the other agencies, the Forest Service, recall that Forest Service has limited delegated authority and for CERCLA, and to the extent that they're performing a cleanup, they went through a non-time critical process and in all likelihood have already done their 106 compliance, you could adopt that by reference. Maybe the agency has a programmatic agreement, which is agency-wide versus an MOA, which is more, active site-specific. So you might be able to adopt that. Maybe you want to go ahead and do the 106 process because there's culturally significant issues and the like. Or maybe in some manner you just want to address this issue by citing, compiling the different agencies, procedures, protocols, memorandums of understanding, all the while not recreating the administrative and procedural aspects of the 106 process. The point is I believe there's options out there for you. Work with your staff attorney, work with your team, and see what you can come up with. But it should not be viewed as an impediment to moving forward on mixed ownership sites. Okay, and here's some examples. Again, there is the Community Involvement Handbook and the Section 106 flow chart and key elements that you could take a look at should you desire. The reason I threw this module in is oftentimes when you're working with different parties, their world, their reality, frankly, is the 106 process. And it's going to take some time to explain things to them. And upfront, knowing where their pinch points are, what their key concerns are, the better that you can anticipate and prepare for that, the greater the likelihood that you're going to move on in an effective and efficient way. Okay, are there any questions?
There were some questions, but I think just in the interest of time, we'll go ahead and keep moving forward and we'll pause later.
All righty. Thank you. Okay, case studies. I'll try to move quickly here. I have three. First of all, there's the Avery Landing site. This is what it looked like. It's a railroad maintenance and refueling facility that operated from 1907 to 1977. The depot was that for the railroad was the depot I showed you earlier. It was an on-time critical removal action. Initially a PRP lead activity, but they did such an abysmal job that we came in, EPA came in, and we took over responsibility for completion for the cultural resource survey. So here's the timeline. In 6/11, we initiated and completed the substantive requirements of the 106 process. We submitted that to the Idaho SHPO, along with our recommendations. Our recommendation was no adverse effect, and we'll go ahead and do a pedestrian survey and archaeological field study, which is nothing more than a surface walkthrough. SHPO concurred with our recommendation and asked that we look at a couple of other things, a nearby Japanese settlement camp and a CCC camp. When we received SHPO's recommendations, we said not only no, but no. The reason is that those sites were beyond the boundaries of our APE area of potential effects, and we had absolutely no impact whatsoever on those sites. We also submitted the final report, which provided the results of the pedestrian survey and field study, and we started to work on 8:30. SHPO responds to us that it was well done. However, because we didn't get their approval, their final comments, we were not meeting the requirements of Section 106. Well, that's SHPO's opinion. We complied with the substantive requirements. We complied with their comments during the review of the draft final with respect to the survey and field work. So from my perspective, on behalf of the agency, we complied with the act with respect to Idaho SHPO, but SHPO didn't agree with us. and then we offered government-to-government consultation. More back and forth occurred with the tribe than what you see here. Okay, and here's some of the stuff they found. Just to keep this in mind, the picture on the left shows the remnants of the rails. You see like two horizontal lines coming out of the bottom center of the picture, and they're sort of surrounded by gravel. Those were the remnants of two rail lines. The picture on the right is just a picture of stuff, old stuff that was found on site. And I don't say that flippantly. These uncontrolled old sites have a distinct probability of turning into waste dump sites where you'll find everything. This building, the entire structure was raised and excavated below ground surface. And so arguably anything but the rails embedded in concrete was removed and disposed of or otherwise dumped in. A big deal was made of this piece of brick that had security in it, but at no time could we tie that brick to the rail yard. The left slide is another example of what we had to look into. You can see the remnants coming out of the lower left center of the rail line and concrete. The picture on the right, you sort of see this round circle coming out of the middle. That's the outlying concrete, structural concrete for the turntable. And this is just what's referred to as scatters, junk that's found on the site. Whether or not it came from the site, I don't know, but this is what we memorialized. Okay, so that's Avery Landing. The next site that we took a look at was the Bonanza Mine and Mill site. This site is located in South Central Oregon. It was a former mercury mine and mill site at which we performed a time-critical removal action in 2014. That's, this slide simply shows what it looked like at one time in its heyday. This is the process: initiated consultation, completed a CRS, made the determination, no potential to have an adverse effect, forwarded to SHPO. SHPO agreed with us, life was good. We also were in touch with tribes and Douglas County Historical Society. I believe that the reason that this site went so well is that my counterpart on behalf of the state took an earnest interest in working on this particular issue, as opposed to just staying away from it and instead letting EPA calling people without any background whatsoever or any grounding in the state itself. So to me, this is a wonderful example of where consultation early on with your state counterpart is critical to moving through this process quickly. If you don't, it's not going to happen. Here's a picture of the Bonanza mine site. When we got there, it was nothing but a flat site. Residential trailers were set up. We had a family from California here that had moved up and occupied the land for some 3 or 4 decades. These are the waste piles that we had to deal with. All of the trash and debris that you see by what appears to be white material is stuff that had been dumped long since the mine had been torn down. The only real remnants of the mine are the concrete pedestals that you see in the first slide, center left. Other than that, the site had been completely razed and people had moved in trailers and whatnot to live in. These trailers were placed on calcine, which is the waste material. Here's an example of the trailers that we had to go in and clean up. And we did things went well in no small part because of the involvement of the my state counterpart. Josephine Mill number one is where things sort of went to hell in a handbag. We were unable to reach agreement with the SHPO and ended up going before the advisory council. So here's the background on Josephine Mill number one. It's your classic remote, abandoned, inactive mine site, characterized by tailings and waste rock piles, weathered wood, things of that nature. This is a PRP lead, non-time critical site with oversight provided by EPA. Here's what the site looks like. Woody debris on the ground, center top, you can see the remnants of some sort of a structure that was beyond the boundaries of the APE. Here's more pictures of the site, waste rock, tailings impoundments, waste wood, waste tailings pile, and the like. So in 2010, we prepared a cultural resources survey. We identified three features likely to be affected by the removal action. We had the survey was reviewed by another OSC and myself, and regrettably, it stated in there, it got biased that the person making the recommendation or completing the survey recommended completion of an MOA for those three features that are likely to be adversely affected. And that got biased, and that was just the beginning. We went on to indicate that there'd be preliminary excavation of these features and that would be qualified by a qualified archaeologist. So we went out and we took a look at those features, and the archaeologists who took a look at things decided that those features did not embody anything significant that would add to the overall knowledge of the mill, and then that therefore no further cultural resources work was recommended for site. In other words, a no adverse effect determination. And these were the features that they looked at. You can see the waste rock pile, tailings pile, remnants of wooden structures, and just trash. And again, these sites are an accumulation point for people just dumping old stuff. So these are the features that everyone got excited about. So a tale of two perspectives. The SHPO asserted that EPA is required to comply with the administrative and substantive requirements, and it's implementing regulations and counterpart state statutes, and that we failed to do so by not entering into an MOA and obtaining a permit from the Department of Archaeological and Historic Preservation. So that's the state SHPO's perspective. Our perspective, on the other hand, was simply that we were following the dictates of CERCLA and the NCP, and we conducted the action in such a manner as to comport with the substantive aspects of the National Historic Preservation Act. Okay, some of the specific concerns that were raised by us with respect to ARARs is the exigencies of the situation. There was a need for a prompt and thorough response. We had an ongoing, uncontrolled release to a nearby stream. The site was not vegetated, so it was readily susceptible to weather influences and the like. We had limited funding and limited opportunity, limited work schedule. This was up in northernmost Washington. We also went on to say that the NCP is very clear as to which ARARs we might have to follow with. Recall that I said this is a non-time critical removal action. As such, we had to do an ECA, an engineering evaluation cost analysis. At no time during the publication of that ECA and its public comment review period did we receive anything from SHPO or others indicating that we had to do something more with respect to complying with the act. We didn't hear from SHPO until several months later, and nor did SHPO provide a satisfactory explanation as to why the state historic preservation laws were substantively more stringent than the federal. With respect to MOU and permits, Section 121E clearly states that no permits are required, and that we need comply only with the substantive requirements, and consultation with administrative bodies is not considered to be substantive, but rather it's an administrative requirement. All right, so what happened then is that SHPO notified the Advisory Council about alleged inadequacy of EPA's compliance with the Act. Both EPA and SHPO provided additional information as requested by the Advisory Council. The Council issued a decision basically stating that EPA had not followed proper protocol by failing to timely consult with the SHPO, but that this failure did not require any further consideration because we had already mitigated for the loss of potential properties by providing SHPO with appropriate documentation and historic evaluation of the properties. So my opinion of this is that this is a response that you would expect to receive from another federal agency. What it tells me in no unambiguous terms is that we complied with the substantive requirements of the Act. We complied with what with the recommendations that were in the CRS. We complied with the requirements of SHPO to do additional investigation. We did everything. Could you have initiated consultation sooner? Well, of course you could. You could have, perhaps I could have done it a day earlier, or a week earlier, or a month earlier. Who knows? But the simple fact of the matter is that we did do it. My state counterpart that was involved with this only in a limited way. So this is an example of what you can expect. I will say that the Advisory Council was very prompt in addressing this issue. And so from that perspective, I think they did a very good job. All right, that's it for that. I have the final wrap-up modules. So if there's any questions with respect to this, or I suspect the prior one, Jean, I could take those at this time.
Okay, well, we did have a question asking if interested parties can appeal the agency's decisions under Section 106. For example, if an agreement was not reached with consulting parties through the consultation process, and if they are allowed to appeal, what is that process for such an appeal?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I suspect, so what would be being alleged is that the agency was not acting consistent with the NCP or was otherwise acting inconsistent with the NCP. And an NGO, a non-governmental organization, or someone at some point chooses to challenge that. Please recall that CERCLA can be challenged only as in a post-decisional way. In other words, unlike NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, where a challenge can be brought before an agency has made a decision. That's why in many instances you see proposed timber cuts taking so long. For EPA, they can only look at the decision after the decision has been made, and they can only look at the four corners of the administrative record, which is to say they look at the administrative record and not the site file. And so it's possible your site attorney would have to address this, though, that if an agency felt that EPA was inconsistent with the NCP, they would bring a challenge to the decision, and the administrative record would be the location that courts and others would go to so as to determine the, you know, whether or not EPA was compliant in this particular instance with its 106 requirements.
Okay. So that's the only question we have in the queue at this time, so feel free to carry on, and then again, we will pause for additional Q&A later on.
Okay. All righty. Well, here's some observations that I would like to share with everyone as a result of going through this process. But before I get to it, I looked to see if there was any literature out there that might give us a sense as to how the agency is viewed nationwide with respect to compliance. And I ran across this study that was completed in 1999. It wasn't a rigorous academic study, but it was a nice little study nonetheless. And this person sent out a questionnaire to SHPOs throughout the country and asked SHPOs to describe experiences with EPA and EPA's willingness to administer Superfund in compliance with the National Historic Preservation Act. And I'd like to share the conclusions with you. And you can see the questions here. This is to the SHPOs, are you aware that Superfund actions in the state have had an effect on cultural resources? Well, you had 12 out of 30 that said yes, and 17 out of 30 that said no, and one that was completely unaware. So it's about a 50-50 split. Has EPA complied with Section 106 and regulated and related regulations while planning to implement Superfund remediation in your state? Again, it's about a 50-50 split with respect to those SHPOs who knew what the question was that was being asked. On the other hand, you had the better part of half of the overall group of respondents who had no idea. And then, if so, did EPA step forward voluntarily? Again, at about a 50-50 split, 6 out of 11 said yes, 4 out of 11 said no. I suspect the 4 out of 11 did once they were advised of their responsibilities under your act. Has your office had difficulty convincing EPA? This is surprising to me. Again, it's about a 50-50 split. So I'm not sure that this is, you know, really revealing what the nature of the question was. And then, if EPA had complied with 106, how would you rate EPA's performance compared with other agencies with which your office works? And, you know, you sort of, you've got a reasonable distribution here. Instead of typical or better, though, I'm concerned that it's poor or typical. And, I don't know what to say about that other than to say that overall this information suggests that the agency, and albeit it's old, could do a better job with respect to consultation. And that in doing so, that, you know, all of these determinations with respect to eligibility, effect, and consideration of alternative and whatnot could happen in a more effective and efficient way with respect to the agency's funding constraints, schedules, other issues, concerns, and the like. All right, so here's my observations. If your project constitutes an undertaking, and remember that federal nexus, you're doing it, you're paying someone to do it, and the like, and will have a potential effect on a property that is eligible for or included in the National Register of Historic Places, then the act applies and you've triggered the 106 process. And how you go about documenting that is your prerogative. Work it out with amongst your team, with your attorney. If you don't even trigger NHPA, just remember you don't have the responsibility to explain why not. But maybe you'll want to put a memo to the file just to keep track of yourself. Federal agencies retain the responsibility for final decisions. You make the decision. It's not some other entity. It's not the advisory council. It's not the SHPOs. Anticipate having to explain the SHPOs and others the legal parameters of CERCLA, such as 104, 121, and the NCP. And this is something, frankly, that OSCs and RPMs should anticipate having to do just about at any time. I always had in my back pocket an explanation as to my statutory authorities, why I was there, so on and so forth. And you're likely going to have to do that, especially if you're dealing with counties and local county historical societies and the like. They're likely going to have no idea what you're talking about. Okay. There is no substantive requirement to actually avoid or minimize adverse effects. I've torn down many things that were significant, and I did so after I did my due diligence with respect to 106. So just keep that in mind. Your requirement is to consider the effects of your undertakings. Initiate the 106 process just as quickly as you can. The last one is very important. The consultant that you bring on board to help you do your cultural resources survey or your archaeologist or something such as that, in all likelihood, they have a pre-existing relationship with the SHPL. In fact, most, if not all, states require that your selection of such a consultant come off of a list that approved by the state, which is to say that there is a pre-existing relationship between the consultant and the SHPL, which arguably the consultant wants to preserve and enhance, if anything. And so they're going to write a document with that in mind. I don't think I've had a single instance where I've not had to go through and rewrite, and in some instances substantially rewrite, the consultant's document so as to put it in the context of CERCLA to make sure that, for example, the APE was well defined, to make sure that the recommendations are something that I felt were appropriate, consistent with my budget, schedule, and the like, and to exclude anything outside of the context of my APE and CERCLA. For example, on the Avery Landing site, I mentioned the camp, the CCC camp, and the like, something that the SHPLs wanted to get documented but were well out of my scope of activities. And so please, please, please pay careful attention to that. Don't rely solely on your contractors to review it for you, but rather this is you're at that point where this is intrinsically a governmental activity. Others, I can't emphasize this enough, is our obligation as an agency and all federal agencies to consult with tribes. As I mentioned earlier, they have extraordinarily intimate attachment to areas and things of significance that may escape me entirely. For example, the overhang, the one picture that we saw, outwardly I would think nothing of that. On the other hand, we discovered that, not we, but some other entity, discovered that it had extraordinary significance with respect to religious activities engaged by the tribe. So bring them on, no harm, no foul. And then just to expand upon the consultation and coordination with tribes, there's the nationwide policy, and I believe each and every region has amended that with its own interpretation as to how this should be implemented. And within Region 10, there's actually, as part of the Region 10's interpretation of this national policy, there is an annex on ERs, emergency responses, similar to the programmatic agreement for 106. Okay, those are just some of my walkaways. There are many more. It's an easy statute to address early on, if you're aware of it. It's also one that could prove to be very problematic. It's not terribly expensive, but if you do your work up front, you engage your team, you engage others in appropriate ways for the scale and scope of your activity, this could go very, very easily. That's it, Jean.
Okay, so we're going to pause again for questions one last time before we go through our final reminders and close out today's webinar. So one of our participants would like to know, during a FEMA mission assignment under ES-10, there needs to be an asbestos removal at historic property. So in this scenario, is it appropriate to have FEMA conduct the Section 106 process?
Very interesting question, and I believe yes. FEMA would do the 106. They would either do it pursuant to a programmatic agreement. And the reason, you know, the difference between an MOU and a programmatic agreement is an MOU is much smaller in scope and scale than is a programmatic agreement, which is to say an MOU or actually it's a memorandum of agreement, an MOA, focuses on very discrete, distinct sites. A programmatic agreement, on the other hand, is meant to be much broader in scale, does not necessarily focus on a particular situation per se, but might focus on, for example, floods or hurricanes or fires or something such as that. And it's FEMA, as the lead agency, that would have the responsibility for ensuring that that work was completed.
Okay. One of the attendees would like to know, how do you determine when a time-critical removal action is categorically excluded?
Well, that's an interesting question. And so I earlier gave you an example of those types of areas that are categorically excluded. And that might include such things as rights-of-way, airports, concrete containment basins, and the like. Having said that, I would submit that it's not important as to distinguishing as to whether it's an emergency time-critical or non-time-critical action. Because to me, if it's categorically excluded under an ER, for the same reasons that it would be under an ER, it would similarly be excluded for a time critical. The other thing to keep in mind is that, the continuum along which compliance with ARARs evolves is from an ER to a non-time critical. It's really at the ER stage, when things are happening very, very quickly over a matter of hours or days, that you have the opportunity, because of the exigencies of the situation, to not have to comply with ARARs as you would if you had more time as part of a time critical, and certainly more time as part of a non-time critical. And so I would be inclined to look at what are those areas that are categorically excluded and apply those to whatever my action was, is how I would approach it. But it's a heck of a good question, and it is something that I would encourage the person to have a brief conversation with their site attorney and perhaps other OSCs or others, and see how they've interpreted that requirement.
Okay. We also had another participant comment that they tried to follow the link to the programmatic agreement file that you had on the ACHP website, and it's returning an error. So they weren't sure if they found another template, one for the MOA, and if you were familiar with that template or if you knew of another way to access that programmatic agreement template.
Well, I apologize. I must have given the wrong address. You could easily Google just ACHP or Advisory Council on Historic Preservation, and there is going to be a wealth of information. And from there, you should be able to find the programmatic agreement and to pull it out. You could also go to one of the region's 10 area contingency plans and in all likelihood find it included as an annex. And yes, by going to the home site for the ACHP, you can find an example of templates for MOAs, MO, our programmatic agreements and the like. that the Advisory Council website is very good. It's well worth the time to visit.
Okay, so I don't see any other questions in the queue at this moment. So before I go through our final reminders, including how people can access the materials and share feedback, as well as get their certificates for joining us, are there any final thoughts that you'd like to leave the audience with?
Well, like with so many things, while I was an active OSC, I always had a small suite of ARARs that I paid attention to. And it varies depending upon where you might be stationed throughout the country. Almost without exception, I always looked at the Endangered Species Act, Section 7, and the National Historic Preservation Act, Section 106. Very, very easy thing to do. And I would encourage you to come up with a similar approach. And also keep in mind that you're more than likely going to have to explain your authority. CERCLA is an extraordinary statute. I can think of no other federal statute that gives OSCs and RPMs the depth and breadth of responsibility and authority that it does. When you think of all media and whatnot, I mean, it's truly astonishing. And to understand how the acts can be integrated to work in a very effective, streamlined way. Neither the National Historic Preservation Act nor the Endangered Species Act are designed or intended to be impediments. Rather, they're meant to be streamlining activities that you can work with and work through, provided you do so knowingly, that you don't wait until you're in RDRA at a remedial site to start to think about those actions, or during a removal action, a non-time critical, where you didn't do your due diligence and consider ways that you could reasonably mitigate or avoid an impact. So I would just say, you know, make it part of your toolkit, so to speak, and people will love it for it. The agencies, particularly the state agencies, are very appreciative of their role in these types of activities, and in most instances, I've always found that they're more than willing to help you. And that's it, Jean. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so very much, Earl. I'd like to walk the audience through just a few final reminders for today's session before we close things out. We did get a bunch of comments coming into the queue of people just thanking you, Earl, for a great job and sharing a lot of useful information, so I wanted to be sure to relay that. So for those of you who joined us for today's live broadcast, I want to thank you for spending part of your time with us today and just remind you that we do offer free online training like this throughout the month on the Cleanup Information Network or cluin.org. If you'd like to find out about these types of webinars as soon as they are available for registration, I encourage you to sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which comes out on the first of each month, and we always list our upcoming webinars in there along with other resources related to hazardous waste sites. If you are looking for copies of the presentation content that Earl went through, we have those posted on the resources page. So if you're in the webinar right now, just look on the middle right of your screen. You'll see a box that says related URLs. Click on the link that says seminar resources and then press the browse to button. That'll open up that page where you can access the materials we used for today. If you're looking for contact information for the presenter or perhaps myself, maybe you're replaying the recorded version and you have a follow-up question about today's session, you can find our information also on that seminar homepage. And I will ask if each of you could take just a brief moment to fill out our online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery. That is also the way that you'll be able to access a participation certificate. When you access the online feedback form, there's a box at the very bottom. As long as you correctly enter your email address when you're filling out that form and you check this box to certify you were here for the entire broadcast, or perhaps you replayed the entire recorded version. Once you submit your feedback form, you will immediately have access to a PDF participation certificate that looks something like this that you can save for your own records. If you don't check that box or you don't enter your email, you won't be able to get to one of those certificates. If you happen to participate as a group under someone else's registration, each of you can actually follow the link to the feedback form and fill out your own form to get your own certificate, even though you were using someone else's registration spot to join us. And you guessed it, if you replayed this entire recording and you got to this point in that archive version, feel free to follow the link to the seminar feedback form under related URLs, and you too can share your thoughts about the archive version and download or print out a participation certificate upon filling that out and submitting it on in. So, again, I want to thank the nearly 70 individuals who joined us from across the country for today's live broadcast. As soon as the recorded version of today's session is available for on-demand playback, you will receive an email, and we encourage you to share it with colleagues that you think will be a valuable expenditure of their time. Thank you so very much for joining us. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast.